and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Just about everybody knows the name of Harper Lee, the highly regarded author of one of the most important novels of the 20th century, To Kill a Mockingbird. And of course, more recently was released to the public her long-lost novel, Go Set a Watchman. But for as famous as Harper Lee was and continues to be, Harper Lee was and remains something of a figure of mystery as well. And that is what makes the best-selling book Mockingbird even more important, because it yields really priceless insight into who Harper Lee was and what shaped her to become such a gifted writer responsible for a truly seminal work in American literature. The man responsible for this extraordinary book is Charles J. Shields, also the author of And So It Goes, Kurt Vonnegut, A Life. This book, Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, From Scout to Go Set a Watchman, has just been revised and updated to reflect what was actually a very eventful decade since this book first was published back in 2006. And I am truly honored to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Charles J. Shields about his marvelous book, which is published by, if I find that page, by Henry Holt and Company. Charles J. Shields, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm truly honored. I loved your book, and I think many people will find it absolutely fascinating. Maybe we could begin with, even ahead of talking about the revision of your book, if you could just say a word about the challenges that confronted you in trying to write a detailed and meaningful book about Harper Lee, someone who was such a private figure, in some respects even thought of as reclusive, that could not have made your work as the author of this book any easier. Can you talk about some of those challenges and how you managed to surmount them so impressively?
Well, as you say, she dropped out of sight in 1964. She published To Kill a Mockingbird in 1960. The movie came out in 63. She helped promote it. And then she decided that she didn't like being a celebrity and she didn't like being famous. So when I proposed to a publisher that I write a biography of Harper Lee, the response, you know, it was as if I had said, I'll go bring back a unicorn. She didn't leave much of a paper trail either. You know, Harper Lee didn't participate in any writing workshops. She wasn't a member of a foundation anywhere. It wasn't that she was reclusive. That's a word that's often used. More, she just didn't like the spotlight. There was so much attention heaped on her as a result of To Kill a Mockingbird, and she tried to turn away from that. So when I started a biography of her, I realized that I would have to make it part oral history, in the sense that I would have to talk to a lot of people who knew her, who growing up and when she was in college and when she was in New York. But one thing that really played in my favor was the fact that she grew up right next door to Truman Capote in Monroeville, Alabama. They were best friends. And wherever Truman went, Mel was not too far behind, particularly when they went out to Kansas to investigate the famous or infamous Clutter murders in 1959, which became In Cold Blood. And there's been a couple of movies about that. But if I could find Truman, often I could find Nell Harper Lee. Hmm.
The revision, of course, really needed to happen because, as you tell us in the introduction to this new publication, all kinds of things happened to Harper Lee between 2006 and 2016. In your words, Harper Lee was more in the public eye in that decade than ever during the previous half century. Just sketch for our listeners the way in which this last decade was so very, very eventful for Harper Lee, and at least in a couple of instances, for not entirely pleasant reasons.
Well, you're absolutely right. She was quiet for 40 years, and I published the first version of the biography in 2006, thinking that she was getting up in years, and it was established that no second novel would come out. And then lo and behold, during the last 10 years of her life, she got into a copyright fight with not only the local people in Monroeville who run the historical museum there. She felt that they were promoting Mockingbird too much, that she really had the control over the names and ideas behind Mockingbird, and they were impinging on those. Second, her agent tried to take the copyright away from her. As she moved into her 80s, she had trouble with her sight, and she signed a lot of things she shouldn't have signed, with the result that, incredibly, she almost gave away the right to Kill a Mockingbird. She fired her agent, got someone new and younger, but still her problems continued because, you see, her elder sister, Alice Lee, who had always been sort of her buffer with the outside world, passed away in November 2014 at age 103. She was an attorney, and she had done her sister's taxes and always handled the reporters. With her gone, it suddenly seemed that Harper Lee was thrust into much more attention than she'd ever received before, what with the litigation and also the revelation that a second novel was out there and was going to be published, which led a number of people to ask whether she really wanted it published. You see, what confused people about Ghost at a Watchman was that it came out 50 years after To Kill a Mockingbird, when in fact it was written in the late 50s and was a precursor to Kill a Mockingbird. It was an early draft of that book. So Ghost at a Watchman became To Kill a Mockingbird, and then when it came out second, people thought, what happened to Atticus? You know, last time we saw him in the 1930s, he was standing up for a black man falsely accused of molesting a white woman. And then we open up Ghost at a Watchman, here he is in the late 1958s, a segregationist, a racist. He's talking about the trouble that the NAACP is making. So, you know, what happened to our hero? It was two approaches to a subject, but she tried at two different times.
You talk about novel that just came out, and even though Ghost at a Watchman, in what appears to be the body of your book in its original form. So before it had been published for the rest of the public, I mean, you make very specific observations about Ghost at a Watchman. In fact, did you have access to some of it, or was some of it known at that point in time, or is some of that analysis something that you have dropped into this revised edition?
Well, it's a good question. I knew that it existed. If you look at the 2006 edition, I mentioned, I'll take up about a page, I guess, in the earlier version, that there was a manuscript called Ghost at a Watchman, and she had been turning it into her agent about 50 pages at a time. They sent it out, and no one was particularly interested, so they worked on it, her and her agent, and gave it a light rewrite, tried a slightly different angle, sent it out again, and this time, an author, or rather an editor in her 60s, Kay Hohoff at Lippincott, thought the manuscript had potential. So over the next 2.5 years, she walked Harper Lee through a revision, 3 drafts, from Ghost at a Watchman to Kill a Mockingbird. And the principal change was this. Ghost at a Watchman was written from the perspective of a 28-year-old woman coming back from New York in the 1950s and is upset by how her hometown that she loved seems lost in the past and nothing has changed. Her Uncle Jack is still fighting the Civil War in his imagination with a different outcome. And To Kill a Mockingbird, on the other hand, is written from the perspective of a nine-year-old girl who adores her dad. And Kay thought that that was a much more compassionate and endearing approach than a woman approaching 30 who's arguing with her elderly father about civil rights. They went with the nine-year-old Scout instead of the 28-year-old Jean Louise, and that was the major change. So I knew there was another manuscript out there, but I figured that it would never come out because, you know, authors do a first draft of a lot of things, you know, and think, well, okay, that was an early attempt, and they put it aside. And then they go on to something else. I was very much surprised when I heard it was going to be published.
And so this new edition of your book, Mockingbird, then includes analysis that you have done since the novel actually was published and you could see it in its entirety. I appreciate a lot of your observations about it, including the fact that Harper Lee, then laboring over her very first novel, had some problems. One of them was that she struggled with issues of first person and third person and sort of setting a consistent tone. And we sort of feel for her as someone grappling with that and other challenges that are involved in crafting one's debut novel.
Right, exactly. She had written for the campus newspaper at the University of Alabama. And she had written some humorous stories for the campus humor magazine called The Rammer Jammer. But, you know, it's jumping over the Grand Canyon to go from a 2,000-word feature piece to a 68,000-word novel. It's hard to make the action flow and make the reader turn the page. And so, yes, she struggled with getting it right. And at one point, as I say in the biography, both of them, she threw it out the window. When she was on her third draft of what was becoming To Kill a Mockingbird, she broke into tears, took the manuscript, went to the window, and threw it out in the alley and called her editor saying, "I don't want to be a writer anymore. It's too lonely. It's too difficult." By that point, she'd been struggling to tell this story for 8 years, during which time she was a reservationist for Eastern Airlines. So, you know, writing at night and on the weekends and not getting anywhere with it can be a pretty awful experience.
We're speaking with Charles J. Shields, and we are talking about his New York Times bestseller, Mockingbird, a portrait of Harper Lee from Scout to Ghost at a Watchman. This is a book which was initially published back in 2006 because of all of the events which surrounded Harper Lee and over the last decade. The book has been revised, updated, expanded, and is a still more compelling portrait of this remarkable woman. Chapter one is called The Making of Me. And I want us to just talk a little bit about Harper Lee's childhood. You write at one point, "To a pair of young eyes like Nellie's, Monroeville was just a dusty old hamlet." Can you say something else about her feelings for this small little town? Because, of course, we like to think of her as viewing it only through the most affectionate and appreciative sort of eyes.
Right. Well, you know, it's not unusual in life that we appreciate things with 20/20 hindsight. While she was a little girl in Monroeville in the 1930s, she was unusual. And one of the reasons that Truman Capote was her best friend was because they were unlike most of the kids in town. They were middle class. And there was a great deal of poverty in Alabama at that time. They read a lot. They had the wherewithal to go to the movies now and then. And they were pretty bright in school as well, very, very talkative, very outspoken. So they clung to each other. As one person told me, Nell was too hard for the boys and Truman was too soft for the girls. They were just unusual people. Later on, when they became adults, looking back, Truman was not as sentimental about Monroeville as Nell was. He one time said to a friend, "Alabama's no place to become a writer," because there wasn't, you know, anybody to bounce his ideas off of. But now looking back, realized that she was sort of in a timeless place where she felt her father's love. She had the run of the place. She was the youngest of four children. So it was only when she became an adult that she realized that Monroeville was a special place and a special time. And as she one time told somebody, "I intend to be the Jane Austen of Southern Alabama." In other words, just stick to a region and its people.
Hmm. She was a tough little girl. You describe her this way: though she was only 7 years old, Nellie Harper Lee was a fearsome stomach puncher, foot stomper, and hair puller who could talk mean like a boy. But wedded to that image of young Nellie Harper Lee was her protectiveness when it came to this neighbor, this slight boy, who of course was came to be known to the world as Truman Capote. Talk for a moment about that, the fact that she was on the one hand so tough and rough and always ready for fight, and on the other hand showed, in a sense, a gentler, more sensitive side when it came to protecting this this neighbor.
Well, Truman had a big emotional hole. You see, he was in Monroeville by default. His parents were from New Orleans, and they were kind of high rollers. They liked parties. They liked excitement. His mother was very beautiful, and she wanted to be a model in New York. So Truman was born, but by the age of two or so, they realized that when you have a small child, it puts a cramp in your high living. So they dropped him with some distant cousins in Monroeville, three women who were unmarried and all lived in a big house. And he lived there, but he missed his mother a great deal. In fact, one time when she came to visit, he realized that she'd left behind a bottle of perfume. And after she was gone, he drank it because he wanted to keep her essence with him while she was gone. So he appealed to Nell's compassion. Here was somebody who needed protection and who needed affection. And she became his sort of bodyguard, a big sister, something like that. And throughout their lives, even when they were out in Kansas investigating the Clutter murders, whenever the attention would drift away from Truman, she would put it back on him. And it was kind of tough after she won the Pulitzer Prize, because they were out there for the end of the trial, and she had won the Pulitzer, and people would congratulate her and make a fuss about her. And then she would say, "Oh, but Truman's working on something fascinating. Isn't that true, Truman?" And turn it back to him. Because Truman craved attention. In fact, that's what led to their falling out eventually. Not on her side, but on his. She won the Pulitzer Prize. He never won any major literary award. And he thought it was pretty unjust that the little girl next door, who never really cared much about being famous, became famous. And instead, he publishes In Cold Blood, and it doesn't win any awards at all.
Hmm. One of the most important facets of her childhood was the difficulty that her mother had with what seems to have been some sort of mental illness. How much do we know about this? You say at one point that the symptoms suggest that maybe she had some kind of bipolar disorder. I suspect, I'm all but certain, that back in that time, such a clear diagnosis would not have been possible. How much do we know for certain about Mrs. Lee's troubles?
Well, it's really just circumstantial evidence, but the accounts of her tend to agree that some days she was so withdrawn. These come from visitors to the house. Some days she was so withdrawn, she didn't recognize people. She would just give them a blank stare. Other days she was so full of energy and animated that she would run out on the street and instruct people about slowing down because it was too hot. They shouldn't be walking that fast. Or she would go uptown and say things to shopkeepers that were a little bit upsetting. So, it shows all the signs of bipolar disorder. And we know that she went regularly for treatments, as they were called, to Montgomery, the capital, where there was a big hospital. But, in those days, people had euphemisms for those kinds of disorders. She moved into her 50s. People said she was experiencing a second childhood or had hardening of the arteries. Those kinds of phrases have fallen into disuse. But, for an unhappy woman in the 1930s and early 1950s, there was nothing like that for her. She just had to suffer on her own.
Mm-hmm. I suspect, and you pretty much say this, that this was probably one contributing factor in young Nellie Harper Lee not quite fitting in with her peers. I think you quote Truman, actually, at one point as describing Truman and Nellie as apart people, different from most other children their age. You go on to say that one facet of that was in the whole notion of gender expectations and sexual orientation, that there were probably some issues there that probably helped to make this a stormy period in young Nellie's life.
Right. You know, if it wasn't enough that they were big readers and very bright in school and probably the other kids regarded them as kind of eggheads, and also the fact that they didn't really understand their mothers. Truman's mother was not there, and Nell's mother seemed to be sort of far away all the time, distracted. Then the third thing was is that Truman never made a secret of the fact when he was older that he was a homosexual, and Nell Harper Lee seemed uncomfortable with the fact that there were expectations for girls that she didn't want to fit. As Scout says in To Kill a Mockingbird, I will not go willingly into that pink cotton penitentiary, meaning having to wear a dress. She was more comfortable wearing overalls, you know, busting out the back door and doing what she wanted to do. So it wasn't a conscious choice on their part. It was just that circumstances tended to throw them into high relief against everybody else in Monroeville. And, you know, sometimes that contributes to an artistic personality, but sometimes, too, it contributes to a lot of unhappiness. Truman died an alcoholic and a drug abuser at age 60, and I know his end was hastened by his deep unhappiness that he could never address.
Hmm. You do say that Nellie and Truman created a bond over books that put them in splendid isolation. Tell us more about this important aspect of their connection with one another and the enormous difference that books made in shaping who they became.
Well, that's a good question. There was not much of a library in Monroeville. There was a small collection, a bookcase of books you could take out in the store that one of Truman's aunts owned downtown. She was a milliner, and she owned a hat shop. And on the second floor, there were books you could borrow. But apparently, Truman and Nell subscribed to series books that came in the mail. There was one about a boys' club on the Ohio River, and they would solve mysteries. And Truman was apparently aware of Sherlock Holmes as well. So once they realized that you could make your life richer by stories, they not only read stories, they began making up stories. Their father, or Nell's father, gave them an old typewriter from the office, and they began pounding out stories about people on the street and mysteries nobody had solved. They would take turns. One would type and one would dictate. And, you know, like small children, these stories probably ran no more than 100 words. But you can imagine two kids occupying a hot summer day by making up a story and reading it to each other aloud and thinking they had really done something. You know, this was valuable. One of their stories was called The Fire and the Flame, which sounds highly dramatic, you know. But that was their splendid isolation, was living in a world that they could create. You know who's similar to that is the Bronte sisters. The Bronte sisters lived way up in the highlands of England, and their father was a minister, and oh, it was such a lonely place to be. And so they made up stories about a mouse family, and they would write the stories out in teensy tiny handwriting as if they were written by the mice family themselves. And that was their little splendid isolation, was the mouse family. So children will find ways, you know, children will find ways to escape and to go new places.
Hmm. We'll talk about the new places that Harper Lee went in just a moment. I just realized we spoke briefly about her mother and have scarcely touched on her father, who, of course, in many respects, served as the model for the character of Atticus Finch in her two novels. Can you say a word about A.C. Lee? You paint a complex portrait of him as being a very good man in many respects, and yet not quite a saint.
Exactly, yes. Well, A.C. Lee was typical of many white Southerners, people in his generation. His father was a Confederate war veteran who fought at Gettysburg. And A.C. wanted a new South, a South that was could use more business and more jobs. And he was all for progress. He was actually liberal in that way. But, you know, it's hard for us to understand these days how people could have two parts of their minds absolutely separate. On the one hand, be kindly and progressive and think well of people. And on the other hand, think that segregation is the best system, that people should be with their own kind, and there was no need to force people to be together, and that trying to do that would just create a lot of trouble. So A.C. Lee, if you met him and shook his hand at church, you would think that he was a fine, upstanding member of the community, which he was. He was an attorney, deacon of the church, director of the local bank. But if you ask him about his views on segregation, he'd say, well, the Bible supports it. In my father's house are many rooms, meaning that everybody's in a different room. Nobody has to be in just one big room. And that was the attitude of the South all the way up through the Civil Rights Movement, that the South would solve its own problems at its own pace, and that sending in troops and changing the law wouldn't do anything except upset people. So, yes, he was a complex man, but I'll tell you, no more complex than a lot of people like, say, George Wallace, who was a great governor, and on the other hand, was an avowed racist.
We also should make mention, more than a mention, is merited of Nellie's sister, Alice. They had a lifelong bond, maybe surprisingly close, given the fact that Alice was 17 years older than Nellie Harper Lee. And you also tell us about how physically, in terms of appearance, they were quite different from one another. You quote Truman Capote as saying that they were as different as a giraffe and a hippopotamus. But there were things that they really shared in common and made them about as close as sisters could possibly be. Say a word about that relationship.
Well, Alice Lee had to step in as a surrogate parent. When Nell was growing up and making decisions about school and all kinds of social choices, Alice was by that time already one of the few female lawyers in Alabama and a partner in her father's firm. And so as their mother began to fade, Alice stepped up to the plate and became the sort of the second parent. And then A.C. died in the mid-1960s, and now it was just Alice and Nell home together. Ed Lee, their brother, passed away during the Korean War of a sudden aneurysm, very unfortunate. He was only in his 30s. And Louise, their sister, had moved away, was married, and had a son. So it was Alice and Nell. And so as Nell became famous and had problems of money and publicity and things like that, Alice began to call the shots. And I think that's really the reason why Ghost at a Watchman never came out. Alice didn't want it to. She felt that it was an early effort, and it didn't put their father in a very flattering light. The previous Atticus was a better Atticus, more of a hero. So I was not surprised that the book was found, Ghost at a Watchman, 3 months after Alice died. I think it was always known where it was. It was in the law office, but in Monroeville. But Alice didn't want it published. Now that she was gone, all bets were off.
We're speaking with Charles J. Shields and talking about his marvelous book called Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee from Scout to Go Set a Watchman. This is a book that was initially published back in 2006. It has just been republished in a revised, updated, expanded edition to reflect some of the events over the last decade, the final decade of Harper Lee's life. So Harper Lee goes off to college. And it's there from those years that we can really first encounter some of her most significant writing. You tell us already she is showing signs of mastering a key element of good writing, using a voice that the reader can hear. I love the way you put that, because, of course, that speaks exactly to why we cherish a book like To Kill a Mockingbird. And where do you think she developed that, or was that mostly just a natural gift?
the magic of reading is wanting to open a book and be told a story, have a sense that someone is telling you a story, and yet it's just words on a page. And some people overcorrect their own voice in the sense that they worry so much about grammar and the strength of a sentence that it loses all of its appeal. Now, at times, you know, like most writers, could write in kind of a wooden way that didn't sound like her. She published an article from McCall's, something about children visiting Washington and what she would show them. It just doesn't sound like her. She sounded best when she talked like herself. As Virginia Woolf one time said, good writing reads like good conversation. I talked to somebody who knew Nell Harper Lee at the University of Alabama, and she said when she opened To Kill a Mockingbird, she could just hear Nell in the newspaper office on the campus newspaper talking and laughing and responding to people. It sounded like her. It takes a little courage to use your own voice. You think it'd be easy to just write like yourself. But some people think, oh, no, that doesn't sound professional. That doesn't sound important enough. I need to dress this up so it sounds literary. Well, she finally broke through into just telling a story the way she would tell a friend. And that's what makes To Kill a Mockingbird so engaging, is that you hear people on the page talking.
Hmm. What kind of a step out into the unknown did it represent for Harper Lee to relocate to a metropolitan area like New York City?
Oh, it was a big risk, but you know, all important things in life come with some kind of big gamble, whether it's marriage or children or a new job or whatever. She dropped out of the University of Alabama after being in law school for a year. Her father thought she was going to be a lawyer, so it was a shock to him and a disappointment when she said, I don't want to continue. And it was Truman who encouraged her to come to New York. He had already been there for a while. He was writing articles for The New Yorker. And he persuaded her that if you wanted to break into writing, you know, this is the literary capital of the world. You need to come here. So by her going to New York from a small town, a small segregated town of 3,000 in the Deep South, that was a journey. That was a real odyssey. And I don't think anybody in her family thought she would make it. And when she got there, the situation was not ideal. It was right after the war, 1948. Housing was at a premium. She finally got a little cold water flat with no furniture in it, almost ran out of money that she had saved up, and became a reservationist for an airline. So here you've got this young woman in her 20s who's working at a job that's not particularly challenging for somebody of her ability, and writing away, not getting anywhere. As somebody told me who met her at a party in the early 1950s, they said, well, here was this girl from Alabama who was kind of quiet, and when you asked her what she was doing, she said, working on a book, and that was it. And that was typical of a lot of people in the 50s, a lot of the arts crowd. You know, they were doing jazz or something. So nobody asked her much about it, and she didn't volunteer much information.
Right. And I appreciated how you spelled out how in the overall culture of the North, there was often a very much a stereotypical view of what people in the South were like, and with a really an air of dismissiveness, of condescension, and so one thinks about somebody relocating themselves from the heart of the Deep South into a place like New York City, where someone from the South might not be welcomed with open arms or appreciated for who they really were. I mean, in a sense, that deepens our respect for Harper Lee braving a situation like that.
Yes, every time she opened her mouth, people would know that she was from the South. And before the interstate highway system in this country, built by the Eisenhower administration, Americans didn't travel all that much unless they went by train. So meeting somebody from the South was like meeting somebody from France who spoke with an accent. And there were a lot of stereotypes about Southerners. Jack Benny had on a band leader, Phil, I can't remember his last name, Phil Harris. And he did a sort of a phony Southern imitation of a drunk. His most popular song was called That's What I Like About the South. I'm going to go back to Alabama and my grandma's going to make me some hammy. It was a silly novelty song, but people loved it. And also, you know, there was the cartoon character Foghorn Leghorn, this pontificating southern rooster who talks in big words and thinks he knows everything. So, you know, a young woman from Alabama arriving in New York was kind of a touching and, on the other hand, sort of sad scenario for someone who expected to become a famous writer.
Right. One thing that ultimately makes a huge difference for her is she struggles to juggle daytime work as this airline receptionist, as you told us, with writing at night and on the weekends. A breakthrough occurred when she befriended a couple by the last name of Brown, and they extended a gift to her that really made an extraordinary difference. Tell our listeners about the Browns and the, I think it was a Christmas gift that they gave to Harper Lee.
Yes, it was a turning point for her. She was accompanying Truman to rehearsals for a Broadway show called House of Flowers. And she met a man named Michael Brown, who was the lyricist for the show, a friend of Truman's. Michael was from Texas, and that was Southern enough for Nell. And Michael invited her over for dinner to meet his wife, Joy Brown, who was a retired ballerina. And they hit it off. They were bright, interesting people. Michael would play the piano, and Nell and Joy would sing. Well, they invited her over to stay the night, Christmas Eve, because they thought it was, you know, not a very happy situation, waking up in an apartment alone on Christmas Day. She had to go to work later that afternoon at the airline. So they said, well, stay over with us, and we'll have a big Christmas celebration in the morning. So she gets up, and she gives him little gifts. And for a moment there, nothing comes back in return, and she wonders whether she's embarrassed herself by showing up with gifts for them, and they had nothing for her. When they told her to go over to the tree and look in the branches, it was an envelope for her. So she walked over there and found the envelope, said Nell on the outside, and she opened it up, and inside was a letter that began, "Dear Nell, you have 1 year to work on your book." And attached to it was a blank check. And at first she was stunned, and what they wanted her to do was make out the check and the amount of her rent for a year and utilities and food, and just get down to the business of writing full time. You know, when you're working on a book with one hand and writing, when you're working on a book with one hand and working all day 9 to 5, there isn't much time. And what they told her was, if you want to make this work, you got to get up in the morning and hit the typewriter and get going and work all day. So she did exactly that, and that was what created the first manuscript of what became To Kill a Mockingbird, the opportunity just to be a writer in New York. And that's what she'd been dreaming of, and it was only through the generosity of friends that was possible.
Hmm. One of my favorite chapters in the book, Chapter 7, is when you highlight the work of a woman by the name of Tay Hohoff, who was the editor for Go Set a Watchman, a novel which, of course, ultimately was never published at the time. But this is where we really get to, in a sense, meet Harper Lee, the writer, in detail for the very first time. And you quote Tay Hohoff and some really interesting observations about Harper Lee, including this: "I came to believe the cause of her abilities and some of her struggles and her courage was in an innate humility and a deep respect for the art of writing. To put it another way, what she wanted with all her heart was to write, not merely to be a writer." That's such an interesting distinction to draw. What do you think is at the heart of it?
Well, there are people who say, "I should write a book," or "I want to be a writer." But the real test comes if you can apply your seat to a chair and sit there in a room alone and write. And what Tay realized about Nell Harper Lee was that, first, she really wanted to get something published. And second, and this is the most important thing, she was willing to take criticism. Not harsh criticism. No editor, discourages a writer. But instead, sort of take direction the way an actor takes direction from a director. And when Nell first brought Go Set a Watchman to Tay, Tay read it and said to her, in so many words, "This is good, but you don't know how to write a novel. Nobody changes. There's not a sense of writing, rising and falling action." Now, a lot of people, unfortunately, would at that point say, "Well, you know what? I've been working on this for 8 years, and if this isn't good enough, either you don't know talent, or I guess I'm just not going to be a writer." you know, and cut off their nose to spite their face. But instead, Mel Harper Lee said, if you help me, I'll do it. And so for the next 2.5 years, Tay, who was in her 60s and had been in publishing for a long time, helped this young woman put her book through drafts. They got together. They looked over passages. Tay wrote notes in the margin. There's a rumor that Truman Capote wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, but that is just not possible. First of all, Truman was a bit of a braggart, and as I said before, he loved attention. If he had written To Kill a Mockingbird and then it won the Pulitzer Prize, we certainly would have heard about it, and he never said anything like that. I think he actually enjoyed the gossip that he had read the thing, that he had written it. And also, Tay and Nell developed a very close relationship, almost like a mother and daughter. She was a regular at Tay's home, her apartment with her husband, Arthur. So, no, nobody got between them. It was just a young writer and her editor trying to get their first book out. And Tay told Nell, you know, this might not sell more than 2,500 copies, but if it breaks even, you know, if it's worth the printing cost and worth the publicity, you're in. So that's all Nell was shooting for, was to get a book on the shelf that, you know, had some integrity to it.
You recount for us in really interesting detail the experience Harper Lee had of going with Truman Capote to Kansas to tell the story of the brutal murders of the Cutter family, which eventually became the extraordinarily important book In Cold Blood. And, of course, after that comes To Kill a Mockingbird. In what way do you think that experience with Truman Capote was any kind of inspiration for To Kill a Mockingbird, not directly in terms of content, mm-hmm. but do you think the assistance she gave to Truman Capote at that point in time, do you see that as being significant in what she managed to accomplish then and finally writing a truly cohesive and really masterful novel?
Well,
or are they two experiences that just happened to be successive on the timeline?
You put it best the second way. They're successive experiences. Here's what happened. Nell finishes the last draft of To Kill a Mockingbird sometime in October or early November 1959. Not long after Thanksgiving, Truman calls her and says, I have an assignment from the New Yorker to go out to Kansas and do a profile of a little Kansas town that's been traumatized by the murder of a farm family. And I have to, you know, interview people and see how they're dealing with it. And he invited her to go along because he had never been out there, and Truman had no illusions about himself. He talked in an effeminate way. He styled himself as a New Yorker, and he wondered whether he'd really be able to get through to these people. So he brought Nell along as his assistant and his friend to help him negotiate this story. So To Kill a Mockingbird was at the publishers when Nell went to Kansas. It was done. There was nothing to change after that, except maybe some, you know, misspellings in the galleys, the proofs that she would get. So while she was out there, she was Truman's helpmate and friend, and people liked her. They didn't know exactly what to make of Truman Capote. He seemed pretty odd for Kansas cattle country. But they liked Nell Harper Lee. She was one of them. Small town, folksy, nice sense of humor. And they told her a lot of things, which she put into 150 pages of notes for Truman. And he drew heavily on them for In Cold Blood. In fact, the book really should be called In Cold Blood by Truman Capote with Nell Harper Lee. But you see, when In Cold Blood came out in 65, Nell had already won the Pulitzer. And Truman felt like, well, you know, you got your day in the sun, and this is my opportunity. And so when he was asked, how much did she help you? He would say things like, well, she's a good friend, and I'm glad she was along. But never talked about how important her presence was.
As for To Kill a Mockingbird, which of course was a stunning success, one of the most interesting things you do in your book was to talk about some of the reviews that came out at the time. And you say those reviews of the novel really say a lot about where America was at the time that To Kill a Mockingbird was first published. Say a word about that.
Well, To Kill a Mockingbird came out in 1960, right on the cusp of the civil rights movement. If it had come out 10 years earlier, I don't think it would have had nearly as much attention. But civil rights and segregation were on the minds of a lot of Americans, North and South. Along comes this gentle, engaging book told from the perspective of a 9-year-old girl that includes important themes about injustice and racism, a miscarriage of justice in a court of law. So it was very appealing to people. Of course, it's entertaining, as it's humorous in places as well. But the book would not have been embraced 10 years earlier or 10 years later during the Vietnam War. It would have disappeared in all the chaos about that American misadventure. So the book was well-timed. It was embraced. But, you know, that's not to say she didn't get a lot of hate mail, because she did. There were people who wrote to her and said, "You've put the South in a very poor light. You're just a money grubber," like a lot of people who like to portray Southerners as hicks and ignorant. So it was, you know, even when the film was shown in her hometown of Monroeville, after the movie ended, it was completely silent. I talked to some people who were there that night. The film ended, nobody said anything. And they walked out into the lobby, and there were two sides. One side said that the movie was a smear on the South and would give Northerners ammunition. And the second side said, "Well, no, it's about time that these things are come to light." And I think it was charming. So even in her hometown of Monroeville, there was no agreement. In fact, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird was not taught in the public school, the public high school in Monroeville, until 1984.
Wow.
People were still, you know, on the fence about that.
Hmm. And, of course, your book goes to great lengths to explore, if not quite explain, why ultimately Harper Lee withdrew, why she never wrote another novel, and why, in a sense, she became an exceptionally private figure. And you end one chapter by saying, "Almost from the day of its publication, To Kill a Mockingbird took off, but gradually left its author behind." I appreciate that you don't try to give us any easy answers. In just a minute or so, what can you say about this still puzzling question about why Harper Lee withdrew and, in a sense, ceased significant writing?
Well, you know, it's pretty hard to follow up your first novel that wins a Pulitzer Prize with a second novel that's going to receive the same kind of praise. And I think Alice, her elder sister, encouraged her to feel grateful and to accept that she had done something wonderful and be very careful about the next novel that she wrote. Consequently, that can be very paralyzing, to think that everything that you write, you know, for publication will be compared to this book that's read by 100,000 kids a year, and it's become the 20th century Huckleberry Finn. And also, as I said earlier, she did not like the publicity. People kept asking her, "Well, how's the second novel coming? And will Atticus be there again? Oh, I just loved him." And so she found, as an individualist, and Harper Lee was nothing except authentic and just her own person, she found that these expectations were very annoying. She took to calling the book "The Bird." You know, I get more mail about "The Bird" every week than then I get bills. Things like that. In fact, she was at a party one time in Monroeville, and a person came up to her and tried to engage her in conversation about it, and Miss Lee just put down her dessert and went home, because there were times when she just simply did not want to be the author of that wonderful book.
In the introduction to the book, you say, "To Kill a Mockingbird has the hallmark of all great works of literature. It reads you, the reader, as you read it. Great books and stories probe your convictions. Silently they ask what you stand for." And of course, all of us who have read this remarkable book and confronted it and seen the superb film adaptation of it, have had that experience, and I so appreciate how your wonderful book only enhances the experience that all of us have had with this masterpiece. The book again is Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee from Scout to Go Set a Watchman, published by Henry Holt & Company and the author Charles J. Shields. Charles J. Shields, a great pleasure and honor for me to speak with you. Thank you so much for writing such a marvelous book and joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
No, it's been a real pleasure, and thanks for such insightful questions. It was a great conversation.
the music of Elmer Bernstein from his film score to To Kill a Mockingbird.